This is the third lecture in the second teaching cycle on the general subject of the human soul. All things have psychic life. Everything that manifests in form has soul or psychic life. By psychic life, we mean essential, intelligent life. In a sense, a form of consciousness. Everything is conscious. There are grander forms and lesser forms. And last week we talked about the human soul as a concatenation or agglomeration or orchestration of psychic life that it was in somewhat parallel to biological evolution, in that as the human body contains within it many, many different forms and stages of evolution of life organization, from the amoeba-like things that swim in the bloodstream to the great tissues that form the brain and so on, that in the same way the human soul is better understood in the plural as a we rather than as an I, and that the harmony is that which creates the ego state or the I, the harmony of all this psychic life. And so on. Now, that doesn't mean that by cutting off a finger, an arm, or a hand, that we reduce or in any way take away from the human soul. Rather, these are externalizations of that soul that pre-exists and forms and oversees the development of the body, so that even though we might remove an arm or a leg or something like that, we don't take anything away from the universal soul, because it is the body that depends upon the soul, not the soul that depends upon the body. In the same way, we spoke about the monad. I should explain that the language that I'm using in these teachings is the language that comes through a tradition that I have been instructed in, where it has parallels in other systems of thought and other systems of language. If you're familiar with Kabbalistic thought and language, you'll find other words to describe very similar things. If you're conversant with Vedanta or Buddhist esoteric thought, you'll find parallels and similarities to what I'm saying. My particular tradition is that which came through the ancient esoteric Christian, the Armenian, the Syrian, and was brought through the European mystics, and of whom some of the more famous and I might say glamorous masters were subject of much legend and so on, but that are known in Europe and in the in Eastern Europe. And so the language I'm going to use is more in tune with the Christian and the Greek language. So the first term that I will refer to again is the term monad. Monad means that, if we were to make an analogy to the only existent reality in the universe, which is self-conscious as an I, which is all, which we might refer to as God, as a kind of great star that radiates out. We might think of each ray that comes forth, or each photonic burst that comes forth from that sun, as a monad. And it comes forth in a stream. The monads come forth in a stream in time, so that they're not all there initially in some kind of a big bang, but they're continually coming into existence. And there are different kinds of monadic entities and radiations. And the kind that become human beings, ultimately, are the most powerful monadic radiations. They are more powerful than the angelic monadic radiations, because they can actually, their work is to penetrate into the nethermost and the absolute, down to the tippy-toe bottom levels of potential reality, and to transform that and make that sacred, and then to return from the place that they came, triumphant and bringing that back. And the human monad, though human beings think of themselves very often, and we look at ourselves and we say, what a bunch of trash we are, what a bunch of ignorance we are, and so on. Actually, the human monad is the most desirable, most beautiful, most wonderful monad, and that is why it is said that in mystical writings that the humans will, so to speak, judge the angels. That is that although it is the angels, it is angelic guidance that helps the human monad to develop and to grow and to evolve. It is just as though the humans were the children of the angels in a way, the angelic monadic beings, just as our own children, our own younger ones coming in, will end up being our teachers and our masters, especially in this transitionary age. So it is with human beings and these other radiations. Now, human beings are the end product of a grand, long adventure, monadic adventure, into form and space, and into what we might call the plane, the physical plane, or however you might want to refer to that, although the physical plane, so to speak, is really a spectrum of seven fields of action that are graded in their coarseness and their fineness. And the psychic life begins in form. Anything that manifests in form is psychic life. And that is why the Indians are absolutely correct in speaking about the winged people, the birds, and the little crawling people, the ants and things. Each of those is a monadic individual that will one day become a human being, an individual, but is already on our highest levels, exactly equal to all human beings. And however, when we get into lower, more general or generic forms of matter and more subconscious and unconscious, but although there still is consciousness, forms of matter, for example, and we might speak of the mineral kingdom, meaning the elements, the gases, the things that exist as gases and solids and plasmas and everything else, then we can't talk about individuals. We can talk about species and genus of soul or of monadic expression. And they are related alchemically to the things that we call elements and so on. If a thing manifests in form as an individual, say a giant asteroid, or a great mountain or something like that, that has a certain kind of individuality, and it can be approached as an individual, and it has in that sense an individual. But the monad has the property of being able to manifest in form simultaneously in seven forms at once as a human being, and in lower kingdoms it can manifest in many, many more forms. So one monad can be in many, many different expressions in the mineral and the vegetable and animal kingdom, and be developing through many different expressions. So if we talk about something like a giant rock or a giant mountain, we're talking about something that has a monadic reality underlying it, and it can be approached in a sense as an individual, but not in the sense that an individual mammal can be approached, because the individual mammal is a higher individuation of monadic expression. However, there is a great power behind the individual expressions of things like mountains meteors and things like this, and they have very special expressions. Stars, an entire star itself, is a full unified monadic expression. It is the full expression of one monad, and it is the godlike expression of one monad. And so the stars have great intelligence far beyond anything that human beings can express, and they are intelligent beings. And one of the greatest esoteric experiences you can give yourself is to sleep outside under the stars on a moonless night. And the reasons for that, I won't go into why it's important to do this on a moonless night. But basically, the zodiacal or galactic or stellar radiations that come from these monadic beings are extremely enlightening and helpful to people who attune themselves to them. But getting back to the generic expressions of the monad in matter in things like elements like water, and water is not an element, but we speak of it as an element for esoteric purposes. We speak of many things as elements like air and so on. There are individual expressions of these things that we call elementals. They've been given fanciful names like undines for intelligences of water. And there are many, many different kinds of water and different kinds of uses that can be made of water. And the same thing for vegetable oils and the essences of plants and all kinds of different things. They have psychic life, and they are psychic channels to high monadic and angelic consciousness, but they don't express as individuals. For example, a peppermint bush, peppermint plant, is an individual because it grows from one seed, and it is therefore one incarnate expression of an individual. And one could say that when one is addressing a particular plant that grows from one seed, that one is addressing a future human being. But one could not say, when one picks up a cup of water from the ocean, that one is addressing a future human being. One would say, I'm addressing an elemental spirit, and that how that spirit is formed, and we human beings have the power to form those spirits, how that spirit is formed in time and space, how it is manifested in form, has very much to do with how its intelligence is manifested. Now, the ancient art of working with the mineral world, working with idols, statues, was a high tech kind of priesthood. Maker of images like Phidias in Greece, whose works are classic works, and the works of whose students are classic works, were powerful not just because they were beautiful. What made a Zeus that Phidias carved, what made it powerful, was that he made an image that was so close to Zeusness that it was powerful and could be used for sacred purposes. It was through sympathetic magic, so to speak, or through sympathy, that the above was connected with the below, and the above was made accessible to the below. And so Zeus, as a great power of the planet, a great planetary power, a great godlike power on the planet, was made accessible through all the better work that was done by a craftsman making images. Zeus always had to have certain kinds of ringlets in the hair, had to have a certain kind of nose, had to wear certain clothing, had to have other characteristics, and these characteristics were divined by higher psychics. By higher psychics, I'm not speaking of mediums and people who allowed themselves to be captured or taken over by alien alter egos or whatever, but I'm talking of people who were able to go into higher noetic vision and see higher realities, and these people were sacred visionaries, prophets, prophetesses, sibyls, and so on of the ancient world. And the image of what a Zeus face was and who a Zeus was is the same kind of knowledge in the Greek culture as the image of what a green Tara is, or what a white Tara is, or what a Chenmezic is in Tibetan culture. And the better image that could be made of this, the more powerfully this energy could be accessed and was available to humanity. To give you an idea of how universal this understanding was, I think I've told the story before of the athlete Theogonies, who was, after his death, is considered to be a hero. A hero was a demigod. It was considered in the ancient world that anyone who was really, really excelled in human life couldn't just be human. They had to be the result of sacred intercourse between a god and a human somehow. Within a generation after the death of Plato, the legends were being spread that he was the result of sacred intercourse between Zeus, who appeared in the form of a snake, and his mother. And, of course, you know the stories about Jesus and so on. They follow that same form, the idea of virgin birth and the sacred intercourse of a god and a human being and so on. The hero, Theogenes was considered to be a hero because he was such a great athlete. He won for his city and his town. He won practically every event he entered in.
Excuse me, doesn't Theogenes almost mean born of a god?
Yeah, that was the name that was given to him afterwards, just by the name Jesus, Yeshua. Liberation was a name that probably was assumed consciously by Jesus. So Theogenes, as we read in, I think it's Hesiod, I don't mean Hesiod, who is it I'm thinking of? Perhaps it's Herodotus, I don't know, but we read of Theogenes and how great he was and how he won all those contests and things. And then he died. And after his death, a statue of Theogenes was created by using his actual death mask and so on. Statues of living people were made by using death masks and so on, so they could make the most perfect likeness of him. And it was set up in the town square, so he would be like the town saint, the blessing of the town, and he would always be, his power would always be available to people and blessing people. Well, he had an enemy. It was a man he had defeated wrestling over and over again. So this man wanted to get revenge on Theogenes. And so he came to the statue at nighttime when no one was there, and he whipped it with a whip, because that would be a way of hurting Theogenes, because the statue was considered to be that sensitive an instrument between the higher world and the lower world. And he whipped the statue, but in the process of whipping it, the statue fell over and killed him. Now, the statue was tried for murder. That's how real the statue was to people. It was considered to have a motivation, and Theogenes, through the statue, was tried for murder and found guilty. And so the statue was taken, and it was decided that it had to be taken and cast out into the sea. And so it was. And then many people lifted it and took it on a boat and dumped it into the ocean. Well, for several years afterwards, there was nothing but famine and drought. In the area. And finally they sent emissaries to the oracle at Delphi, and they asked what they should do, and her dark reply was, return from exile the one whom you have exiled. And after about a month they finally figured out it meant Theogenes. But they couldn't get him back because he was dumped in the bottom of the sea. But fortunately, not long after, some fishermen caught the statue in their nets, and they brought it ashore, and it was placed in the town with many honors. The reason I tell that story is to give you some idea of the power of the image and the connection of the above and the below through the image. And the reason I mention that is to talk about the power that human beings can create in form in the mineral world, so that the things that we create with our hands and with our technology have not quite individuality, but they have a great deal of psychic power. And it's not too far away from reality to give special names to your automobiles or other kinds of things that we create in this way and form. Because we as human beings have the power to take from the genus of the elemental species, if the species of the elemental genus, geni, and bring together and create out of those things that are, they don't have soul. That should be very clear. But they are intelligent. They have psychic life. They have a very special kind of psychic life. Things that people own, that they use a great deal, that are very close to them, they develop a higher form of psychic life. So the stories, for example, of the story of Geppetto and the little puppet Pinocchio that he carves, and how it becomes from a little boy, or the story of the statue, the Greek story of the man who falls in love with the statue, Pygmalion, and so on. These all represent certain kinds of realities that we make and we create and that we could use. And there's a whole thing on what I call sacred matter, on the sacred use of matter and mineral world, and then the same thing goes for the vegetable world and so on. People can make alliances with plants. You can befriend a plant in a very clear way. The gentleman who did the work with the lie detectors on the philodendrons, before I ever heard of this, I invented an experiment like this myself. I connected a diode to my plants and listened to them through my record player and noted how they responded. The more noise that came through, which is the more one-way direction electrical force that came through, that indicated it came at certain times, but I never did experiments with boiling shrimp or anything. But this fellow who did those experiments with the shrimp and with brine shrimp and so on, and determined that his plants were responding to the death of other life forms and things like that with sensitive responses, did have a very interesting experiment that I don't know if much has been spoken about it, but I think this was described in The Secret Life of Plants book, where he had his polygraph machine hooked up to his philodendron and monitoring it all the time. And he was one afternoon, and he was quite close to this plant now. He'd been keeping it and taking care of it for a couple of years, and that afternoon, about 5:30 in the afternoon, he had an automobile accident. It was very terrifying, and he damaged his car very badly, but he wasn't hurt. And when he went home and checked his plant at exactly that time on the polygraph, big electrical activity. He also got big electrical activity on the nights that he had hot dates. So the plant was psychically attuned to him. It was connected to him. It was feeling. And that kind of feeling, sensitivity, I don't say emotion. This is not emotion. This is sensitivity, sensibility, empathy, that compassion. That kind of feeling is what we call pathotic force, and it's that which exists in all matter. All matter is sensitive. All matter has, as you might say, feelings. And so when the way we treat plants, animals, even rocks, it's very ignorant to think of them as numb and not having sensibility and sensitivity, even though they don't think the thoughts that we have and so on. If you look at an animal that are group animals or hive animals or either like some of the molds and funguses that can exist as individual cells, and they all crawl together and they build a big stalk and they build a big colony and then they can crawl apart again. Or animals more developed along with bees, ants, and things like this. Again, you say, well, now, if we look at this individual ant, is this an individual person? Is this an individual? Is this an incarnation that is building itself into a human soul? No. At this point, the ant is not an individual in the sense, for example, that a cat or a mouse is an individual, but it is close to that, but it is part of a family. One could perhaps consider that whole community of ants to be an expression, an individual expression, or community of bees or something like that. And it's at a certain level in the plant and animal kingdom that we start to be able to talk about that things are assimilated in such a way that we can start to say we have an actual soul, in the sense that a human person has, a human being has a soul, in that there is soul in one-celled life forms, there is a soul in all kinds of things, but there is more of kind of what we might call a species soul as compared to a kind of generic soul that exists in minerals and animals and water and things like that, elemental soul. And we eventually make a transition to what we'll call the individual soul. The soul, when we talk about the soul, there's all kinds of soul. Soul is a very general term that can refer, it's like saying a building. You can talk about anything from an outhouse to the Taj Mahal. Those are all buildings. But a soul is a building. But it has many levels of complexity and growth and expansion and noetic layers of development and so on. So the human soul The human soul is a long, grand evolution that goes through generic and specific, and you might say mineral, vegetable, and animal, and human kingdoms. And in the teachings that I've received, it is said that the human soul, that at the time, that the human soul, the soul itself of a human being, there can be in its newest form, in its youngest forms, there can be 7 expressions of the monad, of one monad in human beings. In other words, you can be 7 people alive at once who are extensions of the same monad, who are coming from the same monad, and these are separate souls, so to speak. There can be 3 human beings alive and oak trees and cows and whatever alive too, all that are expressions of one monad. But as the monad, as the work of the monad and the adventure of the monad through matter and through the assimilation of psychic life, as it grows and evolves, eventually the entire monad is reflected in human incarnations, not any other kinds, but just human incarnations. And when that occurs, there can be 7 human incarnations at any given time of one monad. And these incarnations generally are not... there's all kinds of different ways they can occur. Another, when that work is done through those 7 incarnations that are, and they may not be, ever know each other and may be living close to each other or maybe not living close to each other. In Tibetan teachings, they tell stories of 2 people who are one monad, and how, and they're not twins or anything, they're just separate people, and how when one of them dies, the other one dies. And this kinds of stories, you may have heard some of these stories. But the 7 become, through a process of assimilation and of growth and spiritual achievements, become 6, and then they become 5, and they become 4, and become 3. And at a very advanced stage of monadic evolution, they become 2. And at that point, they're polarized in a male and a female. And then after the time of when the work of that incarnation is done, they become 1 individual being. And that being very often it comes through or leads a life that is either physically hermaphroditic, a person is hermaphroditic, like, for example, the great shaman Hastin Klaw, or as someone like Blavatsky probably was, or that person is ascetic, or that person doesn't marry, or that person remains alone. And it is those expressions of humanity, those beings, that in the past have come through as males, as men. And in the past, in the Pythagorean schools and in the old patriarchal systems, the male was considered to be the completion, the complete whole thing. It had everything in it. And the female is considered to be half a soul. And the male is considered to be a whole soul. But in the coming age, it is women who will be the completed manifestation. In the 6th Uruk race, the final and crowning incarnation will be as a woman, not as a man. And there are reasons for that, though, I don't want to even go into now. And after that point, when there is no need of further incarnation, when there is nothing to be gained from it by the individual soul, it's at that point the soul can make the choice that allows the person to continue, to can take the vow, so to speak, the vow of the Bodhisattva, and to continue working, either incarnating and coming through birth, or working close to humanity telepathically with the elders of the planet, or to continue on its journey, and none of any of these paths is as honorable as any of the others. It doesn't matter, you know. And this is the teaching that I've received from my tradition about the evolution of the monad. And this then leads to certain things that are important to say about human life and the human soul. The first thing is that because the human soul holds within it all that which it has been, and that which it has gained and accumulated, and that which we gain and accumulate in lives is not memories, and it's not even talents and things like that. It's a kind of a nectar that we accumulate. That there's a kind of a sweet nectar and there's a kind of a bitter nectar that we accumulate, and the work is to sweeten the bitterness with the sweet nectar and to build a more sweet nectar in, if I'm putting this in a very simple way. And that would almost sums up what karma is in terms of the human soul, because karma or causation, in terms of the human soul, as it can be carried from incarnation to incarnation, is not a direct thing where, for example, somebody, some New Age psychic will say, well, he's a poor black man today with AIDS because in his last incarnation he was a rich white southerner who was cruel to black men. That's baloney. That has nothing to do with karma. The karma doesn't work that way. Karma is a very different kind of thing. One can simply say that one has accumulated certain kinds of bitternesses, and there are many categories of them, and certain kinds of sweetnesses, and one has to do the work within oneself to resolve these things or to bring these polarities together. And it can happen lots of different ways, and it really doesn't matter how it happens. And no one can understand. It's not a matter of divine justice, God punishing people for things in incarnation after incarnation.